Okay. Saturday night. And such a beautiful day, and you all came to the temple, the Hare Krishna temple. Fantastic. Means we're all wanting to make some steps towards Krishna, right? Something that I heard when I was a very, very new devotee, and it's true. Prabhupada said, if you take one step towards Krishna, he takes 100 steps towards you. And then he explained that Krishna is more anxious for us to return to him in the spiritual world than we are to return to the spiritual world by 100 times. But he doesn't interfere with our free will. He gives us free will. He's encouraging us, forever inviting us, but he doesn't interfere. If we wish to remain in the material world, undergoing the cycle of birth and death endlessly, he doesn't interfere, but he's inviting us, please come to me. And if we take one step, he takes 100 steps towards us. That's Krishna. He's very loving. So thank you all for coming, taking one step toward Krishna. I wanted to speak on this theme, simple living, high thinking, as a phrase that Srila Prabhupada described. This is the Hare Krishna movement. Simplicity, we discussed a little bit actually this morning in our Bhagavatam discussion about living simply. Another more technical way, and even more elegant way of saying the same, is devotional service is the path of nivritti, as opposed to pravritti. Nivritti means progressively increasing spiritual involvement and simultaneously decreasing one's expectations of finding happiness through the senses contacting sense objects. The implications of fruitive life and sensual life, decreasing that one and increasing spiritual absorption. So simple, it leads to simple living and contemplating the highest truth. Krishna is the highest truth. And these are essential foundations of a life in devotion. So that's the theme. Now let's see where this discussion takes us. Let us consider 1,000 years ago, where the human population of the world stood at 340 million. For today, that's less than Western Europe. By 1900 AD, just one century ago, that 340 million had grown to 1.6 billion. That's 100 years ago, little more than today's China. Now today, the world's population stands at 6 billion. And the estimation is that by the end of the 21st century, I don't know how they figure this, but it's going to stabilize. Maybe the host Earth planet isn't going to be able to sustain more than that. Maybe that's how they figure it out. But I've seen this figure many times, between 10 and 12 billion people. Population is getting bigger. The Earth planet isn't getting bigger. And all those 10 to 12 billion, everyone is going to expect his or her share of what planet Earth supplies. But planet Earth doesn't have an unlimited supply. And those per capita, the appetite for enjoying the facilities of the bounties of earth, it's not diminishing, it's increasing. Specifically, the population of India and the population of China, the two largest world populations, are also growing in affluence. And what is being produced from those two countries, of course, there's a fair amount of export, but there's a vast amount of consumption because per capita people have more. This is one little statistic that the government of India, I was told this, I'm assuming it's correct, that they, previously a large income for India was exporting fine quality rice, but they banned the export of fine quality rice because the affluence of India is now people, instead of having rice once a day, they want rice twice a day, and there's more people with more money. So what happens to the rest of the world? They get less rice. And the less rice means it's going to cost more. Remember, it was something like 5 years ago, there was a quota from, I don't even know what those big markets where you get large quantity things. You can only buy one bag of rice per family per week. Yeah? Huh?
Yeah, over here.
Over here, Costco or something like that. Because India's prosperity is increasing, the rice production is staying in India instead of exporting. So the appetite for nature's free gifts has been tremendous. And so our expectations are very great, and the supply doesn't match our expectations, so it leads to frustration. And frustration comes out in violent ways sometimes. Frustration and violence between one person and another person, or one group of person and another group of persons, and just plain old vandalism, where there's nobody in particular that you're against, you just go crazy because you're frustrated. And it's all over the world. The picture is where our expectations, that the anticipation of happiness through contacting the senses with sense objects, yehi samsparshaja bhoga dukkha yonaya evate, Krishna teaches in Bhagavad Gita. These very efforts lead us into bondage, which in Sanskrit is called pavarga. And it also has another meaning. Pavarga is one of the letters of the Sanskrit alphabet. Do you have any Sanskritists here? Pa 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 ma. So Prabhupada breaks that down this way. The fifth set of letters in the Sanskrit alphabet have the following meaning. Pa stands for parishrama, or hard labor. And largely, in the human species, the Ugra Karma civilization of our modern time, people work very hard to get what they want. Pavarga. Parishrama, excuse me. This is the hard struggle for existence. They even make nice monuments for hard labor, like you see here. And following parishrama, hard labor, comes pa, which stands for faina or foam, just like when a horse running very fast, working very hard, foam comes in the corner of his mouth, and sometimes people working very hard, similarly, some kind of little dry, chafing substance comes in the side of the mouth. Pa, from faina, from parishrama. And then following that, pa, bondage. Because of the laws of karma, from the actions we perform, there's reactions to all that work that we perform. We're bound up by karma and the modes of nature. And following bondage, ba is bha, bhaya, or fear. And that's material existence. We don't know what's going to happen one moment to the next. We can bluff our way, or be in ignorance, but actually it's a fearful existence. I had this very memorable little experience once. I was riding in a subway in New York with a very elevated devotee, Rupa Nuka Prabhu. We were going to take care of some common service together. And he was looking around the subway car and said, actually, everyone is in fear because they have their expectation. They want to go from where they got on the train to the next place, but they don't know if they're going to get to the next place. And it's true. I mean, that's just because there's crime and muggers and all that kind of thing in New York. But I was once visiting in Madison, discussing the same point, Madison, Wisconsin. And I was saying, of course, you know, Madison is a far more calm city than some big cities in the country. And in the audience, there was one lady who said, oh, no, in Madison, it's also very difficult. My son, he was coming home from school just the other day, walking through the parking lot, and there was a shootout between one student and another student over some drug thing in the parking lot. He was walking home in a nice little high school in Madison, Wisconsin. It's not safe anywhere. You don't know. Not just you might slip on a banana peel, but there's danger. Padam, padam, yadi padam, natesham. In Prahlad Maharaj's words in the Bhagavatam, there's danger at every step. Everything that's here is temporary. It's going to be taken. And that's a fact. Oh, bhaya. We don't know what's going to happen next. And so, pa, pa, ba, ba, and ma. Mrityu, death. Whatever it is that we've gained, it's taken away by death. So that's the reality. That's, you know, the skeleton that, upon which you hang this human form of life. It's the bones. The bare bones, facts, that's material existence. It's a hard struggle. And is there a solution or is there an alternative? And the Vedic model says, absolutely there is. By the design of the Creator, there's an arrangement already made along with the creation for the welfare and well-being and upkeep and maintenance of the creation. The Creator isn't whimsical. He didn't create a situation for everyone to struggle. But people are struggling because they don't know that natural arrangement. Here's what Ishopanishad says. Those of you that know the verse, you can chant along with me. Om Purnam Adak Purnamidam Purnat Purnam Udakshate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishtate. And the translation, Prabhupada's translation, the personality of Godhead is perfect and complete. And because He is completely perfect, all emanations from Him, such as this phenomenal world, are perfectly equipped as complete wholes. Whatever is produced of the complete whole is also complete in itself. Because He is the complete whole, even though so many complete units emanate from Him, He remains the complete balance. That's very nice. What does it mean? It means 1 - 1 = 1. Spiritually. Don't put that in your mathematics exam. But the spiritual mathematics is the Supreme One expands into so many ones, and when He expands into so many ones, He remains complete. 1 - 1 = 1. And for the completeness of that expansion from the Supreme Lord, the next here's the natural arrangement. It's already complete. And then Ishopanishad, the first text, reads, Isavasham idam sarvam yatkincha jagatyam yagat tena chaktena bhuntita ma griddha kasasiddhanam. So it said, I'm not going to just read the translation, you all can read. If we follow the Isavasya spirit, where Isha is the controller, and we follow the reality that there is a controller, and the controller is taking care of our necessities, if we take only those necessities, leaving aside what is not necessity, knowing well to whom it belongs, when we live that way, we can live very peacefully. That's the injunction of the Isavasya spirit. But human society isn't like that. Prabhupada gives the example of a bag of grain. If we householders do this sometimes around their home, they put something out there for the squirrels and the birds, and they don't find that a squirrel comes along and grabs the whole bag and takes it to his place. Or the bird comes and they'll take what they need, something, and then they fly away. And some others come and they take theirs and they go away. But a human being comes along, oh, look at this, and I could take it to my storeroom. So the Isavasya spirit is to not do that, but whatever it is, our necessities, God is supplying them, except as the provision of God, offer back to Him as service unto Him, and not more than that, not more than one's necessity. So there is a natural arrangement by God, by the Isha, by the Purnam, the Parama Purnam, the Supreme Personality of God that has made all these nice arrangements. And for not only for our maintenance and sustenance, but everything of our whole existence. It's already, there's a natural arrangement. But people don't honor that. While there's a natural arrangement, we find, so this is, the title of this presentation is Paradox of Progress. And here's some of the paradoxes. We have better gadgets to make our lives simpler, but our lives are in fact becoming more complicated. It's a paradox. We have far more comfort and better transportation, yet we find we have less time. Yes? So far? People sometimes say, I have too much to do and too little time. Heard that one before. I need more time. I want to enjoy my life more, but I'm always running around. I never have time for myself. This just isn't life. I'm so stressed out. So many expletives like that. Give me a break. I have no balance between my personal life and work. Or the other side, I'm bored. Give me some spare time and I don't know what to do with myself. This is this bondage to parishrama. And people are very busy going from this place to that place to find their happiness. And somewhere between this place and that place, it eludes them, it slips through their fingers. Why? Within our modern time in history, we have taller buildings but shorter tempers, wider freeways but narrower viewpoints. We spend more but have less. We buy more but enjoy it less. We have bigger houses and smaller families, more conveniences but less time. We have more degrees but less sense, more knowledge but less judgment, more experts but less solutions, more medicines but less wellness, You get the theme. That there are these paradoxes. Are we really progressing? We have multiplied our possessions, but we have reduced our values. We talk too much, but love too seldom and hate too often. We've learned how to make a living, but not a life. We've added years to life, but not life to years. We've been all the way to the moon and back, but have trouble crossing the street to meet our new neighbor. These are the times of tall men and short character. Steep profits and shallow relationships. These are the times of aims for world peace, but domestic warfare. More leisure, but less fun. More kinds of food, but less nutrition. These are the days of two incomes, but more divorce. Of fancier houses, but broken homes. It is a time when there is much in the show window, but nothing in the stockroom. Life in our world today, it makes you think. Where are we going? Are we really progressing? Or is something else what's going on? Progress today is often measured by advancement of technology. Countries that are doing that, they're advanced, modern. And what does technology do for us? It's basically the same thing, but you do it faster. And so, especially in the West, it's either more or faster. And then that's what technology is aiming for. We have an addiction to speed. Remember at the Detroit Rock Theatre, I heard this really loud sound, roaring sound. It was we were by the Detroit River and it was a boat race. It was so loud. It was like an airport with the planes taking off. It was just, you know, right over on the other side of where the Rock Theatre was, just boats having a boat race. Like these kind of boats. Speed is everything. And just something for a thrill. Risk your life. Put on crash helmets and ride the rapids. And speed. Adrenaline. Makes happiness. They don't show the picture of all the throw-up coming down the bottom. Dripping down to those cars that are upside down. Fast foods. Practically, it's like gambling our lives, living on the edge, and hope for some thrill. And that's progress of our modern society. Why people can't slow down. We're in a society that's a value. More and faster. So we're like drop a piece of wood in a river that's moving during rainy season, there goes the piece of wood. It's just a neutral thing, a piece of wood, and it's gone. Because the current, the macro level of society that we're living in is faster, faster, faster. I remember Shridhar Swami, my godbrother, who is no longer with us, but he was giving a class, and he said one sentence that really made a lasting impression. He said, for how many centuries have armies and civilizations tried to invade India and change the culture, but it didn't work. Even this one and that one and the other one, and the culture stayed the same. The 5-star TV has transformed the culture of India so rapidly. And then what to speak of all the other forms of technology. I was passing by in Vrindavan, in Loy Bazaar. I saw a crowd of people around the little bitty shop. I wondered, what's going on? And I looked up and there's a TV screen about that big. There's some Bollywood movie showing and there were, you know, 300 people crowded around the little shop to see the whatever it was on that screen. It's Technology has captured the mind of modern society. And not only speed and capture the mind, but to create that technology, there's so much waste, visible and invisible kinds of waste in the whole industrial process, and it just doesn't go anywhere. There's a mountain of tires, 6 million tires, and they don't know what to do with them, so they just make a mountain of them. And here's a list of things that, you know, are part of the waste production that people don't know what to do with. The list can be much longer than this one. I'm going to speak a little bit about this one here. Nuclear disposal problems. One of the places that I visited for some time was Dr. Rajiv Dubey, who was the department, mechanical engineering department head at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. And he was also an interdepartmental head of the robotics division for that university. So it had many electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, civil engineering, and different, you know, divisions of engineering to make robots. And the specific application that they were commissioned to work on was robots that would take care of nuclear waste, because you can't have people deal with nuclear waste because it's lethal. It's radioactive. So they would get robots to go into where the nuclear waste was, scoop it up, put it in a capsule, seal the capsule, put the capsule in the back of a truck, and the truck would drive away. And then they'd take the truck to some place in West Virginia, dig a hole, drop it in the hole, and drive away. Until they found out that the capsules were leaking. And so radioactive stuff was going into the water table. It didn't just affect that area, because water table goes laterally in all directions. So he described to me, they were having these quarterly meetings with the Department of the Interior, the Department of Energy, and the Department of this and that. You know, the Washington bigwigs, they'd go to this place in West Virginia and talk about what to do. And to him it was obvious. Until you solve the problem, you don't continue to create more problem. But they couldn't decide that. And they couldn't decide. The argument was, we need the energy. But the subtext was, we need the money. We need the money. So we're just handing a stick of dynamite to the next generation with the fuse burning. And then they hand it to the next generation, so it blows up. But they know what they're doing. So he quit. He just it went on for some a year and a half, something like that. He couldn't take it. I can't have the responsibility for handing this burning stick of dynamite to the next generation. He said what he had to say, and they didn't want to hear it, so he bailed. And that's just one of so many. Here's a little old report, but this company does their studies every 2 years, so this is a nice one. They have a more recent one, but I like what they said. The natural health of planet Earth has declined about 30% since 1970, according to new calculations from World Wildlife Fund. Listen to this paragraph. It's an impossible and dangerous trend, the fund's experts say. Impossible because at current rates, humanity is using up the planet's resources so fast that by 2050, when the human population will have grown by an additional half to 6 to 9 billion, we will need 2 Earth planets to meet the demand. And please note, we don't have 2 Earth planets. we only have one. The amount of consumption of resources is going to require, now it's at 1.5, and by 2050 it's going to require 2. But we don't have 2. It's, I mean, kind of obvious, but. So what does that lead to? It leads to strife between one nation and another nation over resources. Dangerous because even the most essential resources, clean water, think of what's going on in China today. Big, big, big problem for that. Big, big, big country. 1/4 of the world's population, they don't have enough water supply. So what are they going to do? One of the things they're doing is they're trying to convert salt water into potable water. They're the leaders in the world in that technology. Guaranteed, there's a downside to whatever it is that they're doing to convert ocean water into arable water for their agricultural needs to support their 1/4 of the world's population. Clean water, productive land, timber, and fiber products will be increasingly scarce, fought over by the more desperate nations, and hoarded by the more fortunate, if habits haven't changed. And habits are not changing. There's this enormous waste. And life is expendable if it's convenient for me. People are turning resources into waste faster than nature can turn waste back into resources. Is that slowing them down, Dave? They need more energy, so they're producing as much as they can from oil and oil refineries and gathering raw materials from the land in whatever the climate, whatever the cost. Since the early 1980s, we've been drawing down natural capital faster than it can replenish itself. It now takes nature about 1 year and 3 months to replace what we use in 1 year. The math doesn't work. This is the more recent, 2008. So they're not giving a doomsday prediction. They're saying they're just stating facts. The demands are unsustainable. Human demands on the world's natural capital has reached nearly a third more than the earth can sustain. Most of us are propping up our current lifestyles and our economic growth by drawing and increasingly overdrawing on the ecological capital of other parts of the world, the third world parts. You know, China is investing huge amounts of money in the Caribbean and in the Guyanas. You know, at least for the United States, that's an issue because it's so close. But they want the resources. They've got the capital. They've got a big appetite. Their nation does and their production does. If our demands on the planet continue to increase at the same rate by the mid-2030s, we would, so now it was 2006, they were saying by 2050 we're going to need 2 planets. Now it's 2030 because appetites have grown just in 2 years. We're acting ecologically in the same way as financial institutions have been acting economically, seeking immediate gratification without due regard for the consequences. The consequences of a global ecological crisis are even graver than the current economic meltdown. So go back, you know, 3.5, 4 years, and that's what they're talking about, the collapse of the economy. Expand, 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 without any thought of what is it sustainable and collapse. These are what the experts are saying. If humanity has the will, it has the way to live within the means of the planet. But we must recognize that the ecological credit crunch will require even more, a bolder action than that now being mustered for the financial crisis. Around 50 countries are currently facing moderate or severe water stress, and the number of people suffering from year-round or seasonal water shortages is expected to increase as a result of climate change. Anyway, the statistics that can go on and on. You probably all have been exposed to some of this, you know, without even looking for it. It just hits you. So the message is, we have to start doing things in a different way. Just today, in our GDC discussions conference, there was a link to a website, an article on Greece. You know, in Europe, they have major financial stuff going on, and Greece is one of the weakest financially. They just borrow and borrow and keep borrowing and don't pay back and keep borrowing, and people bail them out and keep borrowing. So there's a new program that's an initiative has started where using the land for agriculture and, you know, intensive gardening as a means of livelihood for people who don't have their necessities and don't have the money to take care of necessities, even if there was necessities. It's, you know, it's a back to the land kind of initiative. In any case, this message is the constraints, the signal is clear. We have to stop and rethink our program, but it's not stopping. Nuclear power plants and creating products that may have and do have negative properties to them. They have, and once they're very popular, they find out, oh, it's bad. This is one example. This is showing when they found out that lead paint, which is the Cadillac of paint previously, it was poisonous. So what do you do with, now we have all this lead paint? They just poured it into the ocean. And when they poured it into the ocean, the pristine ocean, it has some negative consequences. The living entities that live in the ocean didn't like the lead paint. And the question is, do we have the right to just behave like this? Because we're human beings? We're the powerful ones on the planet. And does any species have a right to just systematically destroy other species because we're stronger? That's not the right way to live. Those who are thoughtful souls, consider what's the consequence of the style of life that we have. Of course, this is an ISKCON illustration, so we all know this one. If we give pain to other living entities, that pain comes back. There's stringent laws of nature. And even if we're ignorant of the laws of nature, the laws of nature are going to act. Meanwhile, life goes on. The population keeps growing. And it gets older, and global wealth is rising, and the demands of people, the appetite is increasing, and the frustration is increasing, and the violence and the crime born of that frustration is increasing. Where are we going? The message here is that at least the present system that we're operating with is not a good system. We have to rethink the system that we're working with, or the paradigm. We have to reset the compass and start heading in a different direction. We're heading very fast in a not a healthy direction. That's the reading. And how can we make a change of direction and the way that we're living if we don't make an internal change? I'll just share this with you. This presentation, some couple of years ago, you can see from the dates of these things. I made this presentation once at Penn State. And the devotees that were promoting the program, they purposely went to the humanities buildings and gave out lots of flyers. So the room was packed. It was nearly, well, a little less than the number of people here. And a large portion of the people that were there, at least one person raised his hand. And in relation to this slide that you see here, he said, what you're presenting to us in 45 minutes, we're getting a whole semester of. So we know this topic inside and out. And, you know, there's a professor here that really is invested in this. He knows the topic thoroughly. And he's training us up. But you know what? even though this is my assertion, even though we know that it's like we're riding in a train full speed ahead, we get a signal from the other side, there's a bridge that's out, and we put on the gas pedal instead of the brake pedal. He said, I know for myself, I have a certain expectation of standard of living. And I know that if I live this way and all of us live this way, what the consequences are. It's a disaster consequence, but I want my standard of living. I have my expectations. And I would say, probably all the other, we did a survey of the kids in the class that I'm attending. We get the same, you know, if people were honest, we get the same kind of an answer. So, you know, if he was saying what this says, if there can be some knowledge of the consequences, but unless there's an internal change, well, it's going to be more of the same. I'll give a different example, but it's basically the same message. I take treatment from an Ayurvedic doctor, and his name is Dr. Pankaj Naram. He has a place in Bombay. So when he was just building his Ayurvedic clinic, because he was just using these little rented places in Bombay, somebody appreciated his work, so they gave a very, very nice donation for him to build a clinic. So he was, you know, taking me through the half-finished building from the top floor down to the bottom floor. At the end, I'll skip what happened, but at the end he said, so with this clinic, we'll be able to take people who are unhealthy and on an Ayurvedic principle, make them healthy. I'm convinced of it. I have experience enough in this medical field. I'm convinced of it. The one thing is, when they finish with their medical treatment and they go back to their routine of life, if they don't change their life habits, they're going to be back again where they were. Because something with their life habit created some imbalance that created the illness. We can even create the balance. We can't make a life change. They have to do that. So he was saying, I think we need to team up. You know, religious people like you, spiritual people like you, and medical people like me, we need each other. I can't change people's lifestyle, but you can. And I said, and you can help make people well so they can do nice spiritual service for Krishna. But without an internal life change, even we know the train is out, excuse me, the bridge is out ahead, are people putting on the brakes? It's a nice illustration from Back to Godhead magazine, showing an individual looking at life. That's what's in the middle. And on one side is birth, and the other side is death, and the middle is life. And what goes in the middle? What are we supposed to do with this human form of life? Asking the fundamental questions like, who am I? Am I truly happy? What's the goal of life? Remember that I was discussing this with this MIT student. You don't need a goal of life, you just live life. And the goal becomes revealed in the course of life. Why is there suffering? That's a, you know, it's a very obvious one. One of the ones that I asked was, why do people treat each other so unkindly? Because everybody wants to be treated kindly. So why do people treat each other some other way? But everybody wants to be treated kindly. So why does it go on? Why does it go on? Everyone wants to be happy. Why are people suffering? Everyone wants to live forever. Why are people dying? Why? What's the program? What's the real problems of life and how to solve them? That's what this human form of life is meant to establish. And to receive that understanding, you need a qualified teacher. You need to be inquisitive, Brahma Jigyasa, but you need a qualified teacher. Even Krishna was placed by his mother and father in the care of Sandipani Muni, so he could learn the basics, spiritual teaching from spiritual teachers. That's required. So we have Bhagavad Gita, Krishna speaking this message of Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, imparting transcendental knowledge in the midst of a whole big epic of understanding right and wrong, good and bad, virtue and evil, duty and neglect of duty. Right in the middle is this essence of all knowledge, of understanding who we are. What's the purpose of this human existence? This takes one to understanding fundamentally what is the soul. And Krishna says some very clear, cogent things about the soul. The soul is taking these images, not cut by a weapon, not burned by fire, moistened by water, withered by the wind. These are material elements, earth, water, fire, air. And the message is the soul is not earth, water, fire, air. It's not a material element. It's unbreakable, insoluble, eternally the same. The soul is invisible, inconceivable, and immutable. Knowledge of the soul is essential for understanding, for the internal change, to direct us differently. Doesn't mean we have to stop eating, or stop breathing, or stop living, or stop working, or it's not a set of no's. It's a question of directing our activity in harmony with our real spiritual identity. Another nice verse from Bhagavad Gita where Krishna speaks about the quality of the soul. For the soul, there's neither birth nor death at any time. He has not come into being, does not come into being, and will not come into being. He is unborn, eternal, ever-existing and primeval, not slain when the body is slain. So that's the position of the soul. Not a material element like this figure running through space, earth, water, fire, air, and ether, nor mind, intelligence, and false ego. The soul is a different element altogether. And once we have an understanding of the soul, we can go down, as it shows from that medium step, or up towards the proper destination. We have free will to make choices towards the soul's natural position, natural destination. These are natural, very simple wisdom messages that come from revealed scriptures. And once you receive it, you can share that with the world. A world that's mad after pleasure, doesn't know how to get it. A world that's trying to seek pleasure through lust, pride, greed, anger, envy, an illusion that the enemies of the living entity are the source of happiness for the materialist. It's very unfortunate. We're almost done. This is a quote from Manu Samhita, where one who abides by Dharma is protected by Dharma, and those who neglect Dharma are destroyed by Dharma. Better watch out. Follow principles of Dharma. The purpose of Dharma is to bring the soul to the position of free from material laws. So, when you're seeking the answers to those core questions of life, it's an opportunity for internal change. One needs proper teacher, Srila Prabhupada is pictured here, and proper teachings, the Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita and ancient wisdom made easily available and accessible in simple language. This is what Prabhupada gave in the form of the Hare Krishna movement, and the purpose of this presentation is to help thoughtful persons who are here. You're here because you're thoughtful persons. You'd be somewhere else if you were not. Saturday night is the time for many people to do many other things besides come to the temple. So if you're thoughtful people, consider the the reality of what I've been trying to present here and what's necessary to make things different. Meanwhile, time is ticking. I was appreciating this just the other day. It was just after Ram Nomi. And only a short number of days because it's Navami, Dasami, Ashtami, Trayodashi, and then Chaturdashi, and then it was full moon. And it just seemed like we just observed Ram Nomi, and there was a full moon. That is tick, 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 tick. Time is passing by imperceptibly. We're not getting younger. We can't re-experience the moment that's gone, the next moment. It's gone. Tick, tick. Life is passing. And what are we doing with this valuable human form of life? What we do with it is going to determine the consciousness that we develop, and the consciousness that we develop is going to determine the life, the quality of life that we have presently, and how that's impacting on others, and our next destination as well. Tick, tick. Tick, tick. Life is passing. Time is passing. Bringing things into being and destroying things. Meanwhile, consciousness is that which is our real identity. The message of spiritual teaching is invest in that, developing your spiritual consciousness, your original Krishna consciousness, and help lead society in the right direction. Hare Krishna. Thank you very much. Anybody attended that Penn State University professor's course and has a deeper understanding on this subject than I just gave? Any comments? Yes.
Maharaj, basically just like a comment, you mean about another kind of an environmental disaster if you may. So there is a giant garbage patch in the Pacific Ocean that's estimated to be twice the size of Texas.
Really?
With plastics, primarily. And this is since the 1950s. So if you're able to, create something, of an island that's twice the size of Texas within, the 60 years, I can't imagine what will happen.
Is it submerged?
No, it's actually floating.
It's floating.
It's floating in the ocean. Yeah, there's a new...
It's floating in the ocean. Maybe they'll try to figure out how to, who's going to own it and fight over it. Wow. Wow. An island of garbage. Okay. Anything else? Okay. Yes. I mentioned the presentation about China. I'm repeating so that you can hear in the back.
When Maharaj Parikshita was ruling the earth, so that time everything was very smooth. There was no factory, nothing, no pollution, and nothing.
But during Maharaj Parikshita there was no pollution, now there's a lot of pollution.
Because of him, because Manu Maharaj was ruling, that time was also going well. When Tampa came, it went down. And when Santanu came, it went down. So because of king or because of citizens, sometimes suffer people or...
What's the cause? Is it a good king, bad king issue, or is it the age issue, or what's the issue? What's the cause? Combination. It's like when you say the age of Kali, it's like saying winter. And when it's winter, what happens? It gets cold, and because it's getting cold, the leaves fall off the trees and the vegetation doesn't grow and things like that. Depending on the climate, snow comes and it covers the soil and nothing can grow. It's winter. It's the season. And during, extend that, and during the season, during the Kali Yuga, the kings, they have less qualification, and everyone has less qualification. The followers have less qualification. The Brahmanas have less qualification. Everything goes down because it's Kali Yuga. But look, who is responsible? Well, you could say the kings are responsible. They could be more connected to Vedic culture. They're more connected to spiritual reality and minister accordingly. But it's Kali Yuga. So, because of lack of qualified kings, things go down. You can say, you can point to any one of them and say they're contributing factors. But it's a symptom of the age. So within the age, there can be more qualified persons. Srila Prabhupada and our acharyas that appeared in this age, they were qualified in an age that's not qualified or surcharged with opposition, as Prabhupada says in the Bhagavatam. So the option is there for those who get on board with the option. But otherwise, those that don't, things become degraded, deteriorated. Okay. So over there, in the, yeah, you have a question? How loud is your voice? So-so, okay.
How do you know what path you're going?
How do you know what path you're going? Ask your mother. She'll tell you. We all need a teacher, and when you're young like you, your mother is one of the main teachers, right? She tells you, you know, which is your shoes and which is your hat. Shoes go on the feet and hat goes on the head, right? You learn that from your mother. And then which path you put your shoes on? Ask your mother. Or when you come to the temple, you have a son, you're enrolled in the Sunday school? Yeah. So there you have a spiritual teacher in the Sunday school. Ask your spiritual teacher in the Sunday school. What path do we know we're on? But you have to have a good teacher. Because if you don't have a good teacher, they'll tell you the wrong path. So one of the things that helps as you start to get a little bit older and you attend the Sunday school program, and just like right now you're attending this class and you're hearing, you'll have more of a sense of what the real standard is. The teachers have to teach according to the scripture. Teachings should be what the teachers teach. So the teachers need to know the teachings. They need to know Bhagavad Gita. I was just hearing there's one teacher that's teaching some of our teenagers. You're sitting next to one of those teenagers that's taking the class of Bhagavad Gita. So that one day, maybe she'll be your teacher and you'll learn Bhagavad Gita from her. Yay! So she's got to learn Bhagavad Gita very well. Because one day she's going to have to teach you Bhagavad Gita. Like that. So learn Bhagavad Gita from a good teacher. Follow the path that your mother and your Sunday school teacher advise you. And then as you learn Bhagavad Gita, then you'll understand, yeah, what mom said was right. And what my Sunday school teacher was right. Because look what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. That's our standard. Bhagavad Gita. Okay? You're in good hands. And thank you for your nice question. Tomorrow you can ask another question too. Because tomorrow we're going to speak about I and mine. That's our topic for tomorrow. I and mine. You know about that one, right? It's mine! You know that one. Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada.
Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada.